Hello. Thank you very much, Andrew, for that great presentation, and thank you to Marianne as well. So we are going to open up the floor to questions now, but I thought I'd lead with a couple of questions to get folks primed and ready. So I guess my first question is to Marianne. Thank you for presenting a view of what a village can do to focus on adaptation by maximizing your parkland. My question for you is, so you started off early in your presentation with an ideal vision for the park that was laid out by the consultants you hired and brought on. And then you set out to raise funds to get as close to that vision as possible. I'm curious, if you don't mind telling us, how close to that vision you've gotten with the funding that you had, or how far off are you from it? And do you have a sense of how much more than the $4.4 million for the project you have it would cost to reach the full potential of that vision?
Actually, I have to be honest, I'm not prepared to answer that question. I know that the $4.4 million will get us past the first phase, and there have been changes since that initial vision. So I'm not really sure where we are with that other part, but I think I think we've got a ways to go to get it really where we want it to be. But I would say we're probably another $5 million.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And Andrew, thank you for showing us the perspective of a wastewater utility and showing us what the potential for a wastewater utility is to really make change at the local, regional, and even global level. You know, it's really interesting that you cited a number of sources for ways that you paid for these upgrades and also for the green infrastructure. I'm curious if whether the Brownfield grant or the State Revolving Loan Fund, did those include in the criteria for funding elements of adaptation, or is that something, and mitigation, or is that something that you worked in and used creatively to get there? Or, you know, do these grant sources, are they specifically focused on adaptation, or was it purely being clever to make sure that you kind of found the other benefits to get those funding sources?
Well, yes and no. So the Brownfield grant was strictly a Brownfield, you know, it was a site remediation grant to remove the underground fuel storage from the and contaminated soil from the old gas station. And then we used our own funds to build the rain garden on top. So they funded, like, you know, 75 to 80% of the cost of that particular one was, you know, the Brownfield grant. So that significantly reduced the cost. But the State Revolving Fund, that project was like a pilot project, and we convinced the state, the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection of the benefits of the multiple, you know, wins you could get, environmentally and community-wise. So they adapted their State Revolving Fund to include green infrastructure. So they now, in fact, not only do they fund green infrastructure as an eligible cost, but they fund it with a 50% grant, basically a principal forgiveness. So basically, we spent, let's say, for example, one of our green infrastructure projects was a $5 million green infrastructure project. They offered 50% up of principal forgiveness for the first $2 million. So basically, that $5 million grant project, they only made us pay back $4 million, $1 million with principal forgiveness. So up to $1 million, 50% up to $1 million. So, and then the $4 million remainder was funded over a 30-year loan at less than 1% interest. So it made it, so a $5 million project basically cost us $140,000 a year in annual debt service costs. So very affordable, and enabled us to do it without having to raise rates. So so basically, to answer your question, the state, we started out with this program of eliminating the flooding problem, and the state was so supportive that they adapted their program, and now they offer it to other municipalities in New Jersey as well.
Great, thank you. I'm curious from either of you, were there other sources of funding that you looked into but weren't qualified to do what you were looking to do here? So, you know, the idea here is that there are not many sources of funding for resilience or adaptation. I'm curious to think about the process a little bit in terms of, you know, you did some research, you were trying to find ways to fund these things, but there's funding available, but it's just not available to do something that focuses on resilience or adaptation. Was there any experience with that either of you could speak to?
Well, I could just, we did look into a, I did first look at the DEC, New York State DEC, to see whether or not we qualified for any of their grants. And I think one of the challenges we have being a village, being limited, there is climate smart communities. And if you become a climate smart community, then you can apply for certain grant funds. But the requirements to do that, we don't have the administrative depth. We don't have enough people to do the work that needs to be done to be qualified. Mm-hmm. So we chose not to go that route. And I also looked at other funding sources like the Empire State Development. And I always look around, but in this case, this grant fund had the LWRP just was perfectly suited for the project. And also with the 75-25 match, it was, you know, that was the way we decided to go. But, so that's, and we stay away from federal funds because that's just not, again, an area that we can actually operate in because we're so small.
Interesting.
So we had two kinds of projects, like I mentioned. One was, you know, we're a wastewater treatment plant. And so basically, one project would be about, you know, resiliency for our plants that against power outages, so and getting off the grid. So all of those projects were absolutely funded through State Revolving Fund. So, you know, which is again a federal EPA program that they give money to the state. So any water utility could apply for those and get funding for any of those projects. The only one that was the exception was the solar panel project, which we got a power purchase agreement, which again could be replicated by any, you know, water utility or wastewater utility. So that's the one thing. But maybe what might be of more interest potentially is what we did in the work we did in the city itself, you know, with regard to the Green Infrastructure Program. So what we did was we formed what's called the Camden Collaborative Initiative. So the Camden Collaborative Initiative is an initiative of, it's a voluntary combination or collaboration among the New Jersey Department of Environment Protection, our own agency, Camden County MUA, the Waste Water Utility, the US EPA Region 2, which is, you know, your New York State region as well, and also about 50, over 50 environmental and community service nonprofits. So what ended up happening was, and I'm thinking about what Marion just said, is that, so for example, we as a wastewater utility qualified for certain kinds of funding that our nonprofit friends did not qualify for. But they qualify for things that we don't qualify for. So, for example, that stream delighting project had like five different partners. We paid for parts of it that were funded through the State Revolving Fund, but then there was a local nonprofit that got Green Acres funding from the state that we, as a governmental entity, can't qualify for. And then we hired the State University of New Jersey, which is Rutgers, to do the design, and they had fun. They had an institution. By having a multiple group effort, we were able to qualify for different kinds of funding and pull together five different sources of funding, as it turned out, and putting it together to make one larger project. So that might be of interest to, you know, to the rest of this group.
That sounds fascinating. I'm wondering how that came about. Who kind of was the guiding force behind that, or the one that kind of kept it all together?
Well, it was our utility that started it, because we were doing that rain with that gas station into a rain garden park. The Camden County MUA were partnering, and then we realized, you know, we could do a brownfield project, but why not do a rain garden? But we don't know anything about it. So we said, let's hire the state university to do it. And then they brought in the New Jersey Tree Foundation as a nonprofit to plant trees, and it was very successful. So then we thought, you know, we can go to community nonprofits in the city of Camden and use them to replicate this throughout, because we did it in our own neighborhood near our treatment plant. We
we use community nonprofit to then replicate the rain garden parks in other parts of the city. And that became so successful that we ended up attracting the Trust for Public Land and the Nature Conservancy and New Jersey Conservation Foundation to help partner in these different projects. So I'd be glad to send more information about it, because there's only so much. But we basically have 60 different groups working on environmental and community service nonprofits working on green infrastructure, brownfield removal, but also like air emissions, illegal dumping, et cetera, all working on their area of expertise. But it all started with that one first project.
Wow. And were you working off of a central plan or central outcome? It sounds like an excellent model that others might want to look at. I'm curious, you know, if you kind of were the impetus of this, how did you decide kind of what projects are in, what projects are out, where you focus on, what are the priorities? Was there any kind of central visioning in terms of that?
There was. So the one thing I will say, one thing that's different between us and, say, New York City and Philadelphia is that we don't own the Camden City sewer system that's flooding. So we're a regional authority. You know, Camden's one of our customers, but we also have 36 other towns that we service. So we don't own the sewer system. We own the sewage treatment plant that services them all. So in a way, that was a handicap, because we didn't have the right necessarily to fix it. But on the other hand, it was a blessing, because it freed us from, you know, we didn't have a consent decree or any requirements. Everything we were doing was voluntary, along with our partners. So it promoted a voluntary spirit, you know, a spirit of volunteerism that was really very positive, which is why I used that George Eliot quote about, you know, the greater good of the world being due to unhistoric act, a voluntary act, that we all can make a difference. And we could do more together than separately. So what we did was, our partners were the Nature Conservancy and Ben Rutgers and the Conservation Foundation. They would help develop the ideas for rain gardens. We used our community nonprofits in the various neighborhoods of Kansas City, and we just met in each neighborhood and asked them, well, where is it flooding? And when it rains, where is it flooding? And then you know, in some cases, it would always be in low-lying areas. We would then identify the best opportunities for rain gardens. So we didn't do any modeling or any, you know, it was very, you know, back of the envelope kind of thing, but very effective. And then ultimately when we wanted to really, you know, because we got the attention of the state, and other elected officials about this project in sort of our homegrown way, we ended up getting a lot of funding from through the state revolving fund to expand it to the point where we're now in a position where we can commit to, you know, eliminating the flooding in the city by 2020. The other thing that helped sort of in a backhanded way was Hurricane Sandy and the flooding of the wastewater treatment plants on the Jersey Shore and in Newark. And so I was able to then argue for this deep, it's not just a flooding issue, it's not just a social justice issue, it's also a resiliency issue. That really, really helped. They always say, you know, never lose the opportunity to take advantage of a good disaster, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, so we started out with the anti-flooding because of the public health issue and social justice issue, but then it worked into a resilience project.
That's fascinating. So another question, you know, we at the at Regional Plan Association and at Lincoln have been focused on this issue of sea level rise. Obviously, you know, the flooding that we're talking about is in some ways there's inland flooding and coastal flooding. The projects that you're talking about are in some ways addressing both of those, but you know, we're currently building adaptation projects, or some projects are building to address the flooding that comes from the sea levels today. But if we look ahead to the future, we're looking at, you know, anywhere between 1 and 3 feet over the next 50, 60 years. Are the projects in that both of you mentioned in terms of the flooding, are they factoring in a certain level of sea level rise, or are they planning for the sea levels of today?
Well, I can, in Patchogue, we are looking at the future, and so our engineers initially we were raising the coast, I mean, the shoreline, and actually we're not sure where it's going to end now, because at the time we initially applied for the design grant, that was 2016. And so, you know, it's constantly changing, as we all know.
Yep.
So we're hoping that it'll be enough to accommodate the future. We don't know at what point that's going to be. You know, at this point, it's six. We're 6 feet from the water, the top of it, and we may go higher. And one of the things that I keep in mind is that what are our residents going to say? Because they're not going to be able to see the water the way they do now. They will have to go up onto the boardwalk, and that's why the boardwalk is key in our project, because a lot of the other, and I've done some research regarding other living shorelines that are around, will actually be one of the longest, I think, in the region. It's going to be 1,500 linear feet. Will definitely be the largest in the South Shore Estuary Reserve. But it's also, the other ones I've looked at haven't been this public areas that are park. And so we really are mindful of what our residents and what visitors are going to see. But I definitely feel that the ultimate goal is to think to the future, to protect the properties that are there, to protect against the storm surge, and also deal with the sea level rise as much as we can.
Great. Thanks, Marianne. Andrew?
So, yes, we've definitely taken advantage of or factoring in sea level rise. So one of the things is, this is an opportunity for any wastewater utility or any community, but particularly wastewater utilities. We were asked by the US EPA Office of Water in D.C., in their headquarters, to participate in the climate change resiliency program, and as a result, they helped us model our treatment plan for resiliency, and also to that's where we found the Delaware River rising by 1.5 feet in 30 years. So we put in action all of our designs for this extra river rise, and what we're doing is basically one, trying to make our plant more resilient, like I said. We're also building a living shoreline as well in front of our plant, and in front of this. So we're building a mile-long living shoreline from one end to the other, which will provide some resiliency for the treatment plant, but also it'll be a habitat for an endangered species of mussels in the Delaware River. So we're, again, the benefit of all these partnerships and the collaborative initiative, we're working with the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary, one of our community environmental nonprofits, to design the living shoreline in a way that will be advantageous as a mussel habitat, plus also provide some resiliency against river level rise. We're also, as I mentioned earlier, building some pumping stations along the shore to pump the water out against the higher tide. So that's what we're looking at the moment, but there's much more that needs to be done. I'd recommend two resources to the group. One is the national resource with the EPA's Office of Climate Change. They have a free program, like a computer program, an interactive program that enables you, your water treatment plants in your community, to identify vulnerabilities and link you up with solutions that other treatment plants across the country are implementing. That's free. I'd be glad to let, it's called the CREATE program, CREAT. I think it's climate resilience or something. I'd be glad to provide a link to it if any of the communities want to make sure that their water treatment plants in their community know about it. It is a free service that the EPA offers. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is, in your own state of New York, I happen to be serve on a panel at near Hyde Park with the New York State climatologist, Professor Mark Wysocki, who works at Cornell. And he made an amazing presentation about the impact of river level rise in New York State, and what is likely to come, and what needs to be done in response. And Professor Wysocki did a memorable presentation, and I'm glad to provide funding information for him too, because he really had quite a bit of info for everyone.
That would be great if you could share those. We will send that out to the network. Thanks, Andrew.
I'd definitely be interested here in Patchogue. We have, in Suffolk County, only about 20% of the county is sewered. So Patchogue has one of the few sewer treatment plants, and so that's why we were able to do the high density, but we also are working on, we expanded our plant and we're going to expand it again, but with, obviously, it's right along the Patchogue River, so I definitely would like to bring that information back. There's something I'd like to mention, because regarding the permitting for our shoreline, because in New York State, and this is just, I don't know this for a fact, but what I understand from having spoken with our consultants is that the New York State DEC doesn't have, at least down in our area, not had a lot of experience or I guess I shouldn't really qualify what it is, but there was concern regarding the DEC and us developing a living shoreline. And I know the DEC now is accepting that as something, but we did invite the DEC to be part of our advisory committee, and they've been with us along the way. And we've also reached out to the Army Corps of Engineers to be part of our advisory committee, although they probably won't, but they are going to meet with us ahead of time to look at our plans. And the Army Corps does have a national permit for living shorelines, and we are just going to work to see that ours qualifies under that. But that, you know, that's also something that impacts your progress, because, you know, you can design something, but then for us, it takes some time to get the permits in place. And I'd also like to add on to what Andy said about, you know, the collaborative nature of this. We don't get funding from Stony Brook, but we do have a professor there who's going to be on our advisory committee, as well as the Sea Grant will be part of our advisory committee, and Fire Island National Seashore. And so we're trying to have as many experts in the field to look at our plans to make sure that, you know, we do it once and we do it right, and also so that we do have the state agencies involved, so that we also can satisfy them that, you know, with what their needs are, and that it's going to go according to what that they're looking for. So anyway, I just wanted to add that in the discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Marianne. That was actually one of my other questions was about permitting, and in particular on natural shorelines, you know, the difficulty in doing that. I think the point is that it's so new, you know, that this is a new idea where we're kind of trying to bring nature back to our built environment, and we don't necessarily have the permits. We have the permits there to kind of prevent that from happening, from turning it into that, but we don't have necessarily the permits to get it back to that state. I'm curious, Andrew, if you have any experience with that permitting as well in New Jersey as Marianne laid out in New York.
Yeah, so what we did was, and most of our projects have been done in the way I've got described, and that we use like an environmental nonprofit to make sure that we hire a civil engineer, a conventional civil engineer, to do the nuts and bolts designs and the rain gardens, the stream daylighting, the living shoreline, et cetera. And then we hire as a sub-consultant, like an environmental group, whether it be Rutgers or the New Jersey Tree Foundation or the Trust for Public Land, or in the case of the living shoreline, the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary, to make sure that it's being designed in an environmentally sensitive way, in a triple bottom line way, not just a single bottom line, where the civil engineer customarily would just be looking at lowest cost and, you know, that sort of thing. We want to make sure there's environmental benefits. So we utilize the Partnership of the Delaware Estuary, because we're the Delaware Estuary, and we have been working with Corps of Engineers to get the same kind of national permit for the living shoreline. And it is tedious, but they are... they are looking at it in a way, because I've been at some meetings with them. They understand that we're not trying to build a shopping mall, or, you know, like we're actually on their side. We're on the same side as they are. So they're helping us, you know, design it in a way that would be, you know, good for the mussel habitat, but also, you know, resilience for our shoreline, but also, you know, not, you know, cause any problems with access to the river. That's the things that they're channel depth, those kinds of things.
Great. That's really useful. And you both mentioned the power of co-benefits in this, that yes, there's a function that's being served to protect from flooding in one case, but that co-benefits, the fact that there's a park where people gather in both cases. I'm wondering if you could speak to that a bit more and just, and really, I guess, I don't know, find ways to encourage everyone to focus on this idea of co-benefits and how that really plays in with the community. Because sometimes, as like you mentioned, Marianne, you might lose views of the water, but the other co-benefits that are there kind of help get communities past that. What is the experience in terms of the community reaction to these ideas and visions? And the power of co-benefits in kind of convincing both community members and some of the funding that you're seeking.
So it's I think the community buy-in, we kind of went with the Living Shoreline and you know, we were at that first meeting and now we're kind of running with it. I think it's more in line with our grant application process because you know, what we really want to do is improve our parks. And we've had the Regional Economic Development Council on Long Island, it doesn't view parks as economic development. And so getting money for parks improvement is a challenge. We've made a few applications. We're not the only community. They don't get funded. And so our give back to the community is the improvement of the parks. And the Living Shoreline, it's also, I think it's more locally, and I just mean in the 500 homes in the floodplain, that see that as a positive. Because if you're not in that floodplain, you're not being flooded, you don't get that damage, it doesn't really impact you, and you don't quite understand. So we can get the buy-in for the local people, but the people who are further away, I don't think they know. But if they know we're improving their parks, then that's a big deal. And for the Regional Economic Development Council to satisfy them that this is economic development, that this is downtown revitalization, and those co-benefits, that dovetails with their priorities. So, I'm just really impressed with what Andy's doing down in Camden, and I think it's great to hear about seeing what others see as, that there are opportunity zones. And I think sometimes when we have communities, because Patchogue was in the 80s and 90s, was just really a depressed area. We had 50% vacancy rate. We were our downtown was really dying, and the mayor saw our sewer plant as our positive. And so we were able to revitalize based on that, but hearing how Camden's coming together and that collaborative effort and the fact that there are opportunity zones where people think we improved an area that was a bunch of vacant homes and people didn't want to see that anymore, so they were open to affordable housing. And I think taking advantage of those opportunities that people see as negatives and turning them into positives, I mean, I'm really impressed with what Camden's doing.
Well, thanks, Mary. I mean, ditto. I mean, I was very impressed with what you got to do it too, with smaller resources. And I think the common thing is that each of us can go above and beyond our normal, comfort level, or, and look for opportunities to make more of a positive difference. And I think even more now than ever, with our country facing these challenges, whether it be climate change or infrastructure issues or the awful political situation, on both sides, individuals have to find ways to step up and find ways to do more, leverage our efforts further. So this idea of collaboration is really, really important. I will say this for our community, because they were dealing with combined sewage, this terrible sewage flood. First of all, they didn't even know really that it was sewage. I mean, they just thought, oh, our basin floods every time it rains, or our park floods. I mean, when I told them that, well, there's actually combined sewage. It was a social justice issue. So it cried out for help. And so that's why we were able to attract so many partners, because, it was like a triage situation in a sense. And so, and ultimately so much funding. So that was really helpful, but it's very much replicable. But the key, I think, is to find, an entity that could backstop it, with the financing. So utilities do, and we don't have unlimited resources, but we do have reasonably large resources. And so partnering with our environmental community service partners really helped us, leverage their efforts and leverage our efforts further than we could have done separately. So I would definitely encourage that model. But the reason that the residents, we didn't have to convince them at all, was because they they wanted to get rid of this flooding problem. So we could turn it into give them a green park as well. It really was like the icing on the cake as opposed to the cake itself.
Great. Well, thank you. Any questions from the audience?
Hi, this is Avery Gilbert. I am a consultant for Pew, very much not an expert in this area whatsoever, and I'm so intrigued by this presentation. Thank you both so much. My mind is just bursting with ideas after this. The work you're doing in Camden, Andrew, is just incredible and inspiring. What I realized is a big question. You had mentioned that there was data on turning, basically abandoned blighted areas into green parks. Did you say that you saw some data on that, on the economic benefits of that?
I have seen data about it. I mean, so the Trust for Public Land is one of our partners, and of course they work all around the country, mm-hmm. and they've been citing statistics that show that green infrastructure reduces, has economic benefit, reduces crime, it has a number of ancillary benefits that go above and beyond, just the water absorption, the functional part of it. So I can definitely share that, obtain that from the public land and share that with the group.
That would be great. Thank you.
There's also, maybe one thing I should mention too is, Sarah Beck was my coordinator or point person. I could get a list of asks with some data, some things I mentioned during this talk in the Q&A part about some resources to provide. But another one that the National Association of Clean Water Agencies did was a compendium of community service practices that clean water utilities across the country do. We're more the exception, not the rule, but we're not a one-off either by any means. There were 14 case studies of clean water utilities. We were one of the 14. There were 13 others that were doing community benefits. I think New York City may have been one of them as well, one of the other 13. And so the idea is to encourage replication so that clean water utilities will see this as a new paradigm, a new norm, so to speak. So I'd be glad to share that with the groups as well. And we also have a lot of information on green infrastructure.
That would be great.
Thank you.
Yeah, we will share these following this call. We hope you all have enjoyed listening and taking part in this webinar. This is a final pitch to, if you're interested in this conversation, for those of you who are not already members, if you're interested in hearing what the Village of Patchogue can learn from the City of Camden and vice versa, this is a pretty unique place to be able to kind of have that cross-fertilization of ideas. It's the only regional climate adaptation network in our region, and we would encourage you to join it. If you're interested in joining this network, it's really easy. All you have to do is reach out to Sarah Brent, who sent out this announcement, calendar announcement, and let her know that you'd be interested in adding your name to this, and then we will share all these resources with you, and you can take part in future webinars. And that kind of leads me to bringing up what is coming up next. We will hold our next webinar in mid to late April. We're finalizing the details on that. It's going to focus on the idea of design in adaptation and how we ensure that the designs we do include adaptation pieces, but we'll look at it from the design perspective. Today we looked very much at the funding perspective and kind of touched on design. This next webinar will focus on design. And then we're very excited to announce that we will be holding a conference here in New York City at Regional Plan Association, and it's called Honest Conversations. It's going to be on May 14th. And the idea of this is that, this is such a tough topic in so many ways, because there are things that we don't feel comfortable talking about. They don't fit in with political time frames, that we're talking about something that's far out in terms of sea level rise, but we don't quite know when it's coming, and that there are going to be tough decisions that have to be made in terms of how we invest or where we don't invest or what changes we make to zoning and things like that. So we're going to hold a conference here, and you are all invited to participate and come and be a part of these conversations, where we hope to really have a safe space to talk about some of the difficult and challenging, but also opportune areas to really incorporate adaptation into our future planning. So hold that date if you can, and more information will come. But again, I'll say, please join us for more of these. Let Sarah Brent know you're interested in being a part of the network, and we will ensure that you're copied on whatever we send out. But I want to thank in particular Marianne and Andrew for their insights and great thoughtful presentations and information that they provided afterwards. I encourage you to keep up the good work that you are all doing. I think we all leave this phone call, this webinar, inspired. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.